They wanted to banish warfare. Oh, Uncle Sam, golly. The United States is the biggest manufacturer of weapons of war. No, so Uncle Sam kind of gave some lip service to dealing with, oh, gee, we got to do something about war. But, you know, at the same time, there was this great interest, the socialist in Europe. Oh, we got to convince the countries across the world to enact these social security schemes. You know, we want governments to provide benefits to the people that live in a particular country. You know, we want the governments to provide benefits, social security programs. Well, Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution says nothing about some giant national retirement program. And yet that's exactly what was being advocated by these socialists in Europe. And of course, you know, by in the early 30s, you know, when the FDR is, those guys are in power in Washington, D.C., you know, they're listening to what's going on over there in Europe. And so the solution became, well, gee, let's attempt to enact a Social Security program, and it will ride along on the greatest power of Uncle Sam of Congress, set forth in the Constitution, which is the Interstate Commerce Clause. So what they did in 1932 is Congress came along, I think, well, maybe in 1934, Congress came along and wanted to create, in response to all this interest in Europe, we got to create these retirement programs. So the boys in Washington try to gin up a way to start that process here in the United States. So the first thing they did is they attached a Social Security program to Congress's power to control interstate commerce. It was applicable to the railroads and, you know, other interstate businesses, primarily the railroads. Oh, we're going to impose a tax on those people engaged in interstate commerce, and that tax is going to be used as a retirement program for the workers. So now I've read, you know, I've got the briefs in these cases, the ones that went to the Supreme Court that I'm getting ready to talk about, and the ones that came out about 1937. And, you know, there was an attack, you know, you can see on the screen, Alton Railway, in addition to a whole bunch of other railroads, they filed a lawsuit against the Railroad Retirement Board, challenging the constitutionality of this tax and this, you know, retirement program that Congress laid out in this, you know, law to provide, you know, the first step in Social Security. So what did the Supreme Court say in this case? Well, in May of 1935, the Supreme Court, having before it the issue of the constitutionality of the first attempt by Congress to set forth a Social Security program here in the United States, you know, this is the decision, Railroad Retirement Board versus Alton Railway Company. Came out in May 1935. Here's what, you know, this quote on the screen is the refined essence of the case. It's the perhaps the meat of that decision. The catalog of means and actions which might be imposed upon an employer in any business tending to the satisfaction and comfort of his employees seems endless. Provision for free medical attendance and nursing, for clothing, for food, for housing, for the education of children, and 100 other matters might with equal propriety be proposed as tending to relieve the employee of mental strain and worry. Can it fairly be said that the power of Congress to regulate interstate commerce extends to the prescription of any or all of these things? Is it not apparent that they are really and essentially related solely to the social welfare of the worker and therefore remote from any regulation of commerce as such? We think that the answer is plain. These matters, obviously, lie outside the orbit of congressional power. Boom. Down the tube. Don't tell me. Maybe I'm a hillbilly lawyer. But I kind of think that what's quoted here, stated by the Supreme Court, that's Social Security and more. National health care. And the Supreme Court, the first time it's Congress that dabbles in this area and it gets litigated and brought up to the Supreme Court real quick. I think that the district court action happened in 1934. And here in May of 1935, the Supreme Court's already had oral arguments in it. I think oral arguments were had within the, 6 or 8 months after the case had been filed. Boom, boom, boom. Went up through the courts real quick. Boy, that to me is real powerful. And this decision has never been reversed. Still valid today. But, like I said earlier, maybe 5 or 10 minutes ago, if you copied all of the cases that dealt with constitutional questions relating to Social Security, you would only end up with a handful. And yet all of the other, if you make copies of all of the other American Social Security cases, it'd fill up my office right here. You couldn't walk from here to the door. It'd be an avalanche of paper. Well, so how in the world do we have Social Security? Well, Joe, let's go down the page. Pardon me. We have winter coming on here in North Alabama. It's going to be cold tomorrow, rainy and then cold. So what in the world, how in the world, Alton Railway, never been reversed. What happened? Well, let me tell you what happened. 90 days, 3 months after the decision in the Alton Railway case, without an amendment, Congress comes along with the second set of legislation regarding Social Security. Now, let me just kind of point to something that's happened in the past. In 1894, Congress comes along and enacts an Income Tax Act. Constitution out of that goes before the Supreme Court in a Supreme Court case and decided in 1894, the Pollock case, Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust. Supreme Court finds that unconstitutional. And then 20 years later, Congress gets around to proposing an amendment to the United States Constitution. And they do that in 1909. And allegedly by 1913, the 16th Amendment is ratified. So for the income tax, it took a constitutional amendment. It took them more than 20 years to deal with that. But in 90 days, all these problems regarding Social Security, you just don't worry about them. Don't worry about them. Here's what happened. In August of 1935, Congress, 90 days after the decision in Alton Railway, they come along with the second round of Social Security legislation. Now, one of those cases that went to the United States Supreme Court in 1937, you can see I've got two of the cases that are real important up here on the screen, the cites to them. One of them is a Charles Stewart Machine. That's an Alabama case. Now, if you were down in Birmingham and going northeast up I-59, kind of off on the north side of that I-59 is Stewart Machine. So Stewart Machine, an Alabama company, went up to the Supreme Court that challenged constitutionality of the second round of Social Security cases. Helvering against Davis, same thing. So the Supreme Court in, probably 1936, I forgot I'd have to go back and look at when the Supreme Court took cert in these two cases. But I've got the briefs. I know I've been through these briefs. I got the Stewart Machine Company briefs, and I got the Davis, the Helvering against Davis briefs. Here you come along, and these people, in light of the second round of Social Security legislation coming out of Congress, don't you know that there was an issue in that case regarding how in the world can you do this? you know, and what do we do with, how do we do this with what the Supreme Court said in the Alton Railway case? And that was an issue in these cases. I know because I've got the briefs, I've read them. So here you have the Supreme Court of the United States being confronted with the second round of Social Security legislation after it had once held it to be basically, you know, read the Alton Railway case, read the whole thing, but you can rely upon the quoted paragraph I got there. You know, it seems real important to me. It seems like it kind of drives that nail in the coffin of Social Security, at least from a constitutional basis. So then where in the world, what could be the constitutional underpinnings for Social Security? You know, Congress comes along in this after with no constitutional amendment, 90 days after the Altered Railway case decision comes out in May of 1935, 90 days later, Congress comes along with the second round of Social Security legislation, the constitutionality of which gets challenged, and the Supreme Court in May 1937 is deciding the validity, constitutional validity of the second round of Social Security cases, which, let me just tell you, you know, if you want the briefs, I can email them to you. But they're, you know, the government kind of scans that stuff and, you know, creates these big files. You know, I've read these briefs, and there are arguments, in addition to a bunch of others, predicated upon the decision in Alton Railway. So how do we find, you know, there's got to be some way, since they in Stewart Machine and Helbring against Davis, the Supreme Court says, oh, it's hunky dory. How's that? You know, how do we make these the decisions in these cases? How do they jive with Alton Railway? Well, I have read. Let's see. I read the Davis decision to look at, you know, knowing that, you know, the briefs was talking about Alton Railway court, you know, to explain this problem, you know, how do you solve this problem with in light of Alton Railway? You know, so the Supreme Court's got to address the Alton Railway issue in some way when it decides the Davis case. And I have spent plenty of time going through the Davis decision. Where in the world is the Supreme Court remotely, at least trying to come to grasp with addressing the implications for Alton Railway? You know, it's got to have an impact on this case. They didn't vacate Alton Railway with this decision. Now, I have located, and Gary Thomason, who is not with us tonight because I think he's sick, you know, Gary agrees that, you know, I've got the paragraph where the Davis court is addressing the Alton Railway contentions of the parties. And, you know, you got to, when you take a look at this one spot, one paragraph, where I contend the implications of Alton Railway are addressed in the Davis case, you know, the only place that could happen in this decision is what's on the screen. But you notice that the Supreme Court's coming along and referring to other cases. So maybe the references to the other cases offers a solution to this problem. Maybe that's the way that they are addressing, well, gee, what? How can this be constitutional in light of Alton Railway? And I think that this is correct. You can read the decision and reach your own conclusions. This is the only paragraph in the Davis case. You know, I quote, let's see, Stewart Machine, that's the first quote up here. But Stewart Machine, you can see that they're referring to Cincinnati Soap. But then Davis goes a little bit broader. In the Davis case, you know, they address this issue a little bit broader. Well, then maybe the answer is in, you know, we need to understand what these cases are that are referenced here. The Supreme Court in Davis says, when such a contention comes here, the constitutionality of the Social Security cases, of the Social Security legislation, when such a contention comes here, we naturally require a showing that by no reasonable possibility can the challenged legislation fall within the bright, wide range of discretion permitted to the Congress. That's how they address the implications of their May 1935 Alton Railway case. It is. What's this Butler case? Butler. Oh, that's a decision by the Supreme Court finding unconstitutional certain aspects of the National Industrial Recovery Act, you know, the socialist legislation of the Roosevelt era. Oh, so maybe you can't sit there and say, you know, that, oh, a decision holding another part of the 1930s socialist legislation, Butler, shooting it down, that could be the basis for justifying the second round of Social Security cases. Oh, well, maybe Cincinnati Soap? What does Cincinnati Soap deal with? Cincinnati Soap is a case, it deals with a tax from the insular possessions. And then the head money cases, oh, that found constitutional, the tax on aliens. When they're getting off the ships, they're being brought over from Spain or England or France or wherever, you know, back this in the 1870s, tax on, you know, the head money cases, tax on the aliens coming off of ships. You know, they're moving to, they are immigrants coming to America, and they had a head tax. And the Supreme Court said, oh, well, it's perfectly constitutional. Well, of course it is. Taxing the aliens as they come into this country. Oh, so Cincinnati Soap and head money cases. Our principle regarding the Constitutional Foundation for Social Security has something to do with taxing the extra possessions. Cincinnati Soap, that was the Philippines, but you know, the Philippines back in those days was one of the extra possessions, even though we no longer have, we got rid of the Philippines, what, 1938, I think is the date. But you know, when Cincinnati Soap was there, this was the Philippines tax. In the head money cases, the tax on aliens. So is that a real possibility? You know, that there's somehow, some way, these cases that deal with justifying the constitutional validity of second round of Social Security legislation, you know, is there some connection here? Well, I note that in passing. Let's move on. Now, Joe, let's, you know, here it is. Wow, I didn't know we've consumed an hour. Joe, can you pull up and let me look? Pull up the file called UN Treaties Medicare. And this is all in that brief, you know, but I just simply copied, you know, so it'd be quick. You know, a lot of people don't understand that, you know, we have, remember when the Democrats were having a debate sometime earlier this year, when was it? I forgot when it was. You know, the question was asked of the Democrats, oh, well, you know, how many of you provide free medical care to these aliens that are crashing into the United States? And they all raised their hand during that debate. Wow, they really care about those aliens. But then again, you know, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, he comes along and, well, we gotta make sure that these aliens have the coverage. Well, you know, the reason why, I'll tell you the reason why Gavin Newsom was wanting to have coverage for the soldiers from other countries that are coming over here, you know, that military force that they're calling, undocumented friends. You know, it's really a combat force. Gavin Newsom wanted to give them insurance, but really, you know, where are these people getting that medical care? They're going to the hospitals. They're crashing into the emergency rooms, and the emergency rooms are providing the care for them and not getting paid. So Gavin Newsom, when he was really advocating the, you know, we got to insure these guys, he was really wanting to make sure that the hospitals would be paid for that care by the state. You know, their emergency rooms wouldn't be, you know, dragging the hospitals down. But I digress. You know, are there provisions in some of these treaties that relate to this subject of providing health care to illegal aliens? Well, you know, I just pulled up a couple. This is also covered in that brief that was on the screen a minute ago, where I'm dealing with the subject of treaties. You know, for example, Article 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, and other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. Wow, they want, you know, the international community wants the governments of the world, when they adopt the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, they want the governments of the world to assume this responsibility. How about the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights? Article 12 says the states parties to the present covenant recognize the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. The steps to be taken by the states parties to the present covenant to achieve the full realization of this right shall include those necessary for, move up, Joe, I can't see the provision for the reduction of the stillbirth rate and of infant mortality, and for the healthy development of the child, B, the improvement of all aspects of environmental and industrial hygiene, C, the prevention, treatment, and control of epidemic, endemic, occupational, and other diseases, the creation of conditions which would assure to all medical service and medical attention in the event of sickness. Now, you know, you can go through these, you know, these, you know, the leftists look at these treaties, wow, man, you know, we need to adopt this. But, you know, after you read something like this, you know, you can see that basically what they want is to establish a government that controls every aspect of your life, you being living in a communist state. But, you know, are there, you know, this, here we have this, now that you've seen how the courts have justified, you know, Social Security, how it fits in constitutionally here in our American Constitution. And, you know, you can plainly see that there are real, you know, there are some real gaps in it. But then you can also see, as I've shown, as I've presented to you during the course of this evening's program, you know, treaties really bring in a whole lot, give Uncle Sam a lot of powers. And here we have these treaties, and you know, there are people running around in our movement that are talking about, wow, we're controlled by England because of this treaty that we have regarding Social Security with England. No. Sit down and read, those are called totalization agreements. You know, you may have heard some people talking about these. You're making the argument, oh, well, you know, here we have this treaty with, regarding Social Security with Great Britain. Those are called totalization agreements. And they deal with, you know, if you're an American citizen, you go and work over in England and you're paying their Social Security tax, and you're also paying United States tax, you know, well, you know, when you retire, you know, which government's going to do something about that problem? And those issues of multiple parties being involved and having an obligation to provide, you know, some of this care, Social Security programs, those are governed by these totalization agreements. And so when somebody comes along and makes the argument, oh, gee, you know, this is a demonstration that, you know, wow, Great Britain controls the United States. No, we have a totalization agreements with a lot of other countries across the world. And so when people sit there and make those arguments, they don't know anything about what they're talking about. But the point I want to make during the course of this evening's program is this. You know, a lot of America, you know, just like we started off during this evening's program talking about equal protection problems, you can see them in ordinary everyday life. You know, now that you see that, have that principle, if you understand that principle, I guarantee you, you will, you know, and especially in today's, the older I get, the more I see, you know, it's popping up everywhere. Well, you know, once you understand something and read, spend a little time digesting that treaty memo, and consider the implications for Social Security, you know, you can begin to see, wow, you know, we've got some real problems over, you know, the Constitutional Foundation for a lot of these programs and their application inside the United States. So, Joe, it's 9:05 my time. We've been going for 1 hour and 5 minutes. And maybe we ought to be coming to a conclusion for this and open things up for questions. Okay. I hope people got something out of this presentation.
I think you noticed, Larry, a few chats that kind of dealt with your talk. Do you want to scroll back and address those?
Well,
looks like Mike had a question, does a treaty expand? And then Peter had a comment about, sounds like Congress. Do you see those?
Let me pull up chat. Well, I see three. Mike, does a treaty expand the jurisdiction of one sovereign within the boundaries of another sovereign? Well, I can see how, you know, a treaty, you know, Uncle Sam, you know, a lot of countries across the world don't have this problem, primarily because they're not like Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam, you know, gee, we're the world's policemen, and we have what, we have military forces in, what, 120 or 140 countries around the world. You know, we've always had this problem, you know, since we're the world's policemen. You know, not that I disagree that we need to be that way. You know, I agree with Ron Paul. But since we have forces all across the world, we do have to have agreements. You know, if you got a big facility like we've had in Germany and Japan for a long time, boy, those agreements with those countries to station our forces there, you know, we got courts. We have American courts in Japan and in Germany. You know, there'd been 80 years this stuff's been going on. You know, so we have these agreements regarding just our forces in other countries. You know, there are agreements that deal with that. And you can plainly see, since we've got, let's say, I don't know how many, how big our forces are in Germany and France and places like that, but I would think we'd have maybe 40,000 people. You know, that's a small city. You know, they're in dealing with, you know, all the problems that come up with American boys over in Germany, you know, and during Oktoberfest, you know, you can predict that there could be some real problems. But, you know, we don't have here in the United States, you know, one of the things that cropped up here recently is, well, gee, here in America, can a foreign country, you know, let's ignore this problem that we're causing for the rest of the world. You know, let's deal with the American perspective. Well, what about other countries having jurisdiction here? Well, the only thing under international law where that is, that comes up is, you know, there's all these treatises on international laws. We have embassies. It's accepted. It's the law in the international circles that embassies, our embassies in other countries and other countries' embassies here in the United States, if they're embassies, they are little parts of those countries. You know, Uncle Sam doesn't have jurisdiction in an embassy. Although, you know, with today's technology, there's probably nothing that we even can concerned about, because we know everything they're doing through all their electronic communications. But, you know, that's the only way that here in America there can be jurisdiction of a sovereign outside the United States having any type of jurisdiction here in this country.
Larry, if I could comment, I don't know if this is what Mike meant, but could he be saying that, okay, we get a treaty with England and they've got, you know, socialism 1,000 times what we have. So getting a treaty with England and then basically bringing in a bunch of English socialism, importing it in through the treaty.
Common core, let's deal with that.
Yeah. You know,
that's a real problem. We're fighting it here in Alabama. Where does Common Core come from? Everything that they're doing right, you know, where does the Department of Education come from? You know, I haven't talked about the education treaties we've got, but there are treaties that deal with education. You know, I maintain that the Constitutional Foundation for the U.S. Department of Education is Uncle Sam's carrying out his treaty obligations to educate. And so it's treaty-based. But then again, you know, this international community, You know, the Common Core starts off in Western Europe, and we're importing it, and it's coming into the States through the Federal Department of Education, the national standards, where, you know, it's a lie for the advocates of Common Core to sit there and say, oh, this was state developed. That's a lie. You know, it comes straight out of the Department of Education. But you got to sell it to the people in the state, so you come up with these convenient lies. But, you know, Common Core is going on in Europe, and we're just our Federal Department of Education likes what they see over there, so they want it to happen here in the United States, and that's where Common Core is coming from.
So, in a sense, if Mike meant that it's like a way to import unconstitutional or colorfully not constitutional policies in America, the treaty's a great way to get the camel's nose under the tent.
Well, you know, remember a couple of years ago, a Supreme Court case dealing with it went to the United States Supreme Court dealing with the reach of some federal law dealing with chemicals. And here's the facts, the Boyd case or something like that. I forgot the name of it, but you know, this lady's husband was running around with his paramour, and she found out about it. Bond. That's what it was. Bond, the United States against Bond. She got indicted because she was putting, chemicals on her husband's girlfriend's car, the handle of open the car on the door to her house. You know, she put chemicals there. I don't know how they found out about all that, but you know, maybe through spying, who knows? But the issue, when that case, you know, there was a constitutional challenge. Congress can't, you know, make penal the mere placing of chemicals on a doorknob in some house here in some state. You know, that's overbroad. So that Bond decision starts off, hey, you know, this law comes about because of a treaty. And one of the things that a lot of people don't do, even lawyers don't do this. You know, a lot of people don't recognize and understand, as I said earlier, as a general rule, if you see something that the federal government is doing that you can't locate in Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution, you can almost bet that the reason for that agency is some treaty. So, and of course, treaties can concern anything.
Presuming I might be reading the minds of a lot of the viewers, though, Larry, is that just the pass? In other words, is there any recourse if?
Well, yeah. This gets back around to planning. You know, well, who's subject to a treaty? And the Supreme Court's dealt with this issue. And you know, this gets back around to, you know, what are the things that I've done tonight before we start the program? You know, a friend of mine sends me this. Somebody had forwarded to him this crazy patriot stuff, you know, and we've all seen it, you know, the insanity that comes about, you know, almost like they're Democrats, you know, the Democrats here in our freedom movement that generate all these crazy ideas. Well, you know, if we could get people out of following the crazy ideas and just devote a little bit of time to, you know, getting into some real meat, you know, of course the real meat, it doesn't have the pizzazz. It isn't flashy and attractive. You know, it requires some work. It's a lot more sophisticated. It takes some while to begin to understand it. But, you know, there needs to be, I see, a tremendous amount of progress that could be achieved by setting forth. There's a lot of cases. We need more cases on the point. We need to establish the limits of international law, domestic. Let's call it domestic international law. You know, the implementation of international law by the Congress of the United States. What are the limits to that? And I maintain it, you know, you can see it in the every now and then in the media, the communists, the Russians and the commies in China, they like this principle. International law doesn't have a domestic application. That is true. The commies will talk about that, but boy, we won't do that here in America. The limits of international law.
Gotcha.
It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like this. Think of the federal government as a house. But the house, inside the house, there are 50 people. The people inside the house are self-governing. Those are the states. This house, the federal government, what it does is it protects us from the external elements. And it regulates who comes in and who goes out. That's the federal government.
I see. Okay, well, it is hour and 15 minutes. Mike, one of the viewers, wanted to let everybody know, he looks like he's chatted to everyone. If anyone would like to have some chat discussion outside of these Wednesday meetings, and of course it's arguably it's one-sided because we try to present some information, and if everybody was chatting back and forth, obviously that'd be a little difficult to do in an hour and 15 minutes. So Mike's idea was that he's willing to give you an email address that's been in the chat here. I'll say it orally as well. It's Tapster, T-A-P-S-T-E-R, at protonmail.com. And so Mike is saying, let's see, I'll just read it to you. I asked Joe if I could extend an invitation to those that regularly attend, if they'd like to have a discussion outside of this meeting. If you would, send an email to tapster at protonmail.com and I'll put a list together. I would like to hear thoughts of others. So,
okay, hey, I'm going to send him an email, but hey, can you bring him on? And, you know, I'd like to find out what his interests are.
Let's see.
You know, there's a real need for us to quit watching Dancing with the Stars, and, you know, we got to devote some time to.
Yes. So Mike should be unmuted. Mike, you there?
Mike?
I had to get the headphones on.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, that mic. Oh, I got you.
All right, hold on just a minute.
Tapster.
Can y'all hear me?
Sure can, yeah, Mike.
Tapster, we can.
Shit.
And maybe just try to make it brief, Mike, but go ahead, Larry. What did you have a question for Mike?
Well, I just wanted to.
Fellas, can y'all hear me? Shake your head, Larry, if you can hear me, because I can't hear you.
Well, we sure can, Mike. Yeah. And hey, I would encourage, you know, if you got an interest, you know, Mike does like, he likes to do this type of stuff. So, hey, I'm going to send him a little note too.
Shit.
And so send it to Mike and, you know, he'll stir something up, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm going to have to make a command decision here, everybody, that Mike could not hear us. So we could hear him, but he could not hear us.
Wait, right now, just what we talked about?
Yeah. Yeah, oh. He couldn't hear us. So rather than just go on and on, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? I think we better just, let's send an email to Mike. Again, it's Tapster, T-A-P-S-T-E-R, at protonmail.com if you'd like to participate. And maybe by next week, Mike can get, you know, plus we didn't give him any time, right? We just called on him out of the blue. But yeah, he couldn't hear us, Larry. So unless you want me to try again.
Something going.
Yeah.
He's interested in anything, I think.
Sure. All right, everybody. So
let's come back next week, folks. Bring some friends. We want to educate our fellow.
Yeah, let me just point out, as I did in the chat, that if you go to agentfortruth.com, the radio show menu item, you can actually see the latest archives, and I have uploaded 2 or 3, 4 shows over the last week or two. It's really helpful if you view the shows, so please go there and view, tell others to view the shows. And then, of course, I do try to post on the Wednesday, if we're going to have a show, the link as to how you can join the show. Sometimes I send out an email, but not always. So the best thing to do is go to the radio show menu item at agentfortruth.com to find out how to join our Wednesday show. All right. Anything else, Larry?
Sayonara. I'm going.
All right. Great. Thanks, everybody. And we'll see you next time.